You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Ahead this hour, we look at two of this year's Best Picture nominees for the Academy Awards. Have you seen The Father or Judas and the Black Messiah? What do you think of these films? Let's talk 800-642-1234. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the answer to a Wisconsin question about a county and its curious shape.
Dunn County in western Wisconsin once had access to the Mississippi River. Its early boundary held for a few years until its southernmost portion got swept up in politics and emerged as Pepin County. Liz Domes-Harder brings us the answer to a Wisconsin question about how Pepin County got its unique shape.
Take a look at a map of Wisconsin. It's 65,000 square miles, cut into 72 counties by relatively boxy borders. There are some exceptions. For one, Pepin County in western Wisconsin that shares a border with the Mississippi River.
The shape of this county looks like a square root symbol, and it's super tiny.
That's Joe Hackbarth. He's a physical education teacher at La Crosse Logan High School. As a fan of geography, he wanted to know how Pepin County got its shape.
I should probably say I have nothing against Pepin County, but I saw the map and it just struck me as, well, that's kind of curious. You know, why does it exist?
When Wisconsin became a state, there already were 28 counties. Here's Howard Varigan, the state's cartographer.
Pepin was part of what was then Chippewa County, which at that time was a much larger entity than Chippewa County is today.
Basically, a wide strip from the Mississippi River northeast to present-day Iron County. Large counties weren't ideal back in the day, especially when services were dispatched from the county seat. For Chippewa County, that was Chippewa Falls.
At Pepin, when we were part of Chippewa, it took 2 days to ride to Chippewa Falls.
That's Terry Mesh. Behind a face mask, he points to a framed map showing the county's former boundary. The map is hung in the hall of the Old Courthouse Museum in Durand, where Mesh is a volunteer manager and tour guide.
So the closer you were to the seat of justice, the sooner you would get service, etc. That's what drove the creation of smaller and smaller counties.
Some men fought hard for that. Men like William Boyd Newcomb, who platted the village of Pepin. In his fight, Newcomb helped carve a piece out of Chippewa County to establish Dunn County. Dunn County was divided into seven new townships. In the south were Pepin and Bear Creek.
William Boyd Newcomb merely asked for the severing, cutting off of these two townships and forming them into Pepin County.
Why? Because he felt slighted by the county he had a hand in establishing. In 1854, he was appointed Dunn County Register of Deeds to fill a vacant seat. Finding qualified applicants was often hard for fledgling counties, and Dunn County was no different.
Dunn County was having such a problem organizing that the state legislature stepped in and they set a new election for November of 1855, before the two-year cycle of a normal term.
Newcomb was effectively ousted from his Dunn County office.
His feelings got hurt bad enough for him to now begin the process of creating a whole new county.
Lots of folks were against the new county, including two assemblymen who demanded that their minority opinion be written into the assembly journal. That opinion piece is printed and framed in the museum. For theatrics, it's read aloud by Mesh.
The shape of the new county is such as necessarily, at first look, must strike everyone of the impropriety of the division. An eye upon the map will speak a loud language.
Not exactly loud enough. Pepin became a county on February 25th, 1858.
WPR's Liz Domes-Harder brought us that story on the curious shape of Pepin County. And that story idea came from an audience member as part of our Wisconsin project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And now for some Oscar buzz. On Fridays in April, we make space to talk about this year's Best Picture nominees leading up to Sunday's Academy Awards ceremony. And next up, The Father, starring Anthony Hopkins, Olivia Colman, and Mark Gatiss. Here's a bit from the trailer.
Laura has come round to help you.
I don't need her or anyone else. I can manage very well on my own.
Everything all right?
Who are you?
Actually, it's me, Paul.
Who?
I live here.
What is this nonsense? Anne?
It's me.
Ah, there she is.
Your father seemed a bit confused.
Have you seen this film? Join in 800-642-1234. Anna Thompson-Hodgick is a senior lecturer at UW-Whitewater and teaches courses on film. Anna, welcome back.
Hi, welcome. I'm happy to be here.
Let's dig into The Father, which is so heartbreaking. Tell us a little bit about this film.
So The Father is about kind of a man's descent into dementia. And the film is told from this character's perspective, portrayed in a really fascinating way here by Anthony Hopkins. Mm. And it is an incredible performance. More on that in a bit. But it stars Hopkins as this character who is, you know, kind of the title character. And, we have seen these kinds of stories before, and they are, you know, generally fairly depressing films. But this film, I would really encourage your listeners to check out, because it is such a creatively told film. And it tells what makes this film a real standout is that it tells the story from the perspective of this character. And so we are as the audience, we are just as disoriented as our title character is. And the director, the first-time director, Florian Zeller, he is constantly playing tricks on the audience. And that is meant, I think, in a large part to mimic what's going on in the mind of our lead character. And so while it is, again, it's a sad story, it is a really interesting way to tell, how this story unfolds. And because we're never quite sure, sort of as the audience, kind of what's going on. And it's really interesting. It's just a really interesting film.
And this is adapted from a play. How does that work cinematically?
So the film is, it does have some stage qualities to it, clearly. But what the director accomplishes is that it also, works cinematically. And there are little clues, right, that we are given as the audience that I think it makes it really work as a cinematic film. And Zeller, he's French, a Frenchman, and I was into some interesting background information on Zeller. He began his career as a novelist. Hmm. Then he pivoted to playwriting. The Father, yes, was started as a play, and then this has been the first film that Zeller has adapted as from one of his very own plays to film. And, again, there are little things that you can accomplish clearly with cinema that you can't obviously accomplish in a play-like format. And ultimately, it just really works well. And one point I've heard that, this is, a play, and it's been compared in some ways from just a staging perspective to the film Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, which did not get a Best Picture nod. And one of the reasons is that it there were some critics that say that it felt really stagey, that film feels really stagey. But that's not the case with The Father. It really does have a cinematic feel, despite it beginning its life as a play.
What made Anthony Hopkins' performance here so special?
Well, again, he is someone that is, slowly, descending into dementia, and he conveys that incredibly well, the kind of, some of the emotions that he brings to his performance, the sort of the confusion, the defensiveness, disorientation, all of that is personified very well by Hopkins. And And he did win the BAFTA award, the sort of the equivalent of the British Academy Awards. And so there is, you know, the conventional wisdom says that, you know, the late Chadwick Boseman may win the Academy Award for his performance in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. But I have heard sort of reports that there's sort of some late breaking surge for Hopkins in his performance in this film. And I believe it really is his very best performance since, you know, since his turn as Hannibal Lecter in Silence of the Lambs, which, of course, is such a memorable role.
Yeah.
This is obviously entirely different, an entirely different performance. But it's a real, it's a real testament to, you know, if Hopkins wins, he would be the oldest living best actor winner, and he's at the age of 82. Hmm. And that's, again, a real testament to his endurance as a performer, for sure.
Well, you touched on this, but the subject of dementia is so heavy, so sad. Is the movie still entertaining in ways?
Well, I find myself, you know, being entertained. It has this kind of devastating ending, which I won't give away, but it keeps you guessing. And it is maybe perhaps a film I'm not necessarily sure I'd, you know, sit through multiple viewings. But part of me actually does want to watch it again because, again, all of these clues, all of these elements to the film that, again, we are, you know, the way the film is set up is such a creative perspective, such a creative point of view. And the way little set pieces change over the course of the film, that is what makes it such an interesting film. Even though it is, again, the subject matter is not the most uplifting in a way, but the performances are incredible. I mean, and then I haven't even mentioned Olivia Colman, who, here she is, someone who's playing Queen Elizabeth on The Crown.
Yeah.
But then turning out this incredible performance in this film as well. She's a former Oscar winner for her performance as Queen Anne in The Favourite. So she is just also a stellar, gives a stellar performance as well.
We're talking with Anna Thompson-Hodgick, Senior Lecturer, UW-Whitewater. Which performances did you enjoy watching in The Father or Judas and the Black Messiah? Who deserves an Oscar Sunday? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. This is an Oscar-nominated original song by her from the movie Judas and the Black Messiah. The track is Fight For You. So these Fridays in April, we're setting aside time to talk about this year's nominees for Best Picture ahead of the Academy Awards on Sunday. Have you seen Judas and the Black Messiah, about the events leading up to the killing of Black Panther chairman Fred Hampton? Join in, 800-642-1234. Anna Thompson-Hodgick is here, senior lecturer at UW-Whitewater. She's our guide. So, Anna, now we're back in the 60s for this historical drama, Judas and the Black Messiah. Can you give us a little bit of sketch?
Yes. So this film is the story of Fred Hampton, who was the leader of the Black Panthers, the Illinois chapter of the Black Panthers. And that chapter was, in real life, was infiltrated by a young FBI informant, William O'Neill. And Hampton was an incredibly charismatic leader, but there was a real fear of him and his rise in power from the FBI. And this is personified in a rather sinister portrayal in the film by Martin Sheen. Daniel Kaluuya plays Fred Hampton in a turn that's, you know, quite a strong performance, and Kaluuya was nominated in this performance for Best Supporting Actor. And this is a film probably, and from a plot perspective, has the most overlap with the trial of the Chicago Seven a film we talked about a few weeks ago. But the primary themes here are social justice, and, you know, clearly making it, like so many of our nominated films this year, incredibly timely in terms of thinking about these elements of social justice and the fight for civil rights. It's a really powerful film as well.
Well, let's hear some of Daniel Kaluuya capturing Chairman Fred Hampton at a rally in the film.
It's not a question of violence or nonviolence. It's a question of resistance to fascism or non-existence within fascism. You can murder a liberator, but you can't murder liberation. You can murder a revolutionary, but you can't murder revolution. And you can murder a freedom fighter.
So what do you think of Kaluuya's performance?
It is really incredible. And, you know, Kaluuya, you know, is fascinating. He is actually a British actor, and you'd never know it from that performance. But he very much, you know, studied the cadence of Hampton's speeches, and worked actually with both a dialect coach and an opera coach.
Wow.
Really have a command of the way Hampton spoke, and really try to deeply understand the way Hampton gave speeches, and really was able to sort of command the room, and it's really good. And so the thing too that makes this film quite notable, that this is the first time as well in Oscar history that the producer team for this movie is entirely African American, and so that is really notable. So you generally have somebody in the background, right, that's raising the money in mm-hmm. some way. And so, like, for example, last week we talked about Minari and, you know, Brad Pitt being one of the producers of that film. This time it is again an entirely African American producer team, and so if this film wins Best Picture, it would go, those Oscars would go to Ryan Coogler, I believe, who is quite a force in Hollywood. He mm-hmm. was the director of Black Panther. And then the director is, again, another first-time director, not nominated for this particular film, but Shaka King is his name. And so he also is behind the producer team. And this is a film, too, that took a long time to get made. A lot of these kinds of movies do take some time. They had been shopping this screenplay around Hollywood for the past 7 years. And finally, got greenlit about 2 years ago. So that, just the story of the film getting made in the first place, I find to be really, really interesting as well.
What do you take away from Lakeith Stanfield's performance as an FBI informant and infiltrating the Black Panthers?
So we really do see Stanfield's performance. You know, he brings that conflict, that inner turmoil, certainly. And, you know, the backstory here is that he was sort of a petty criminal in Chicago. He is approached by the FBI, and in exchange, you know, the various charges against him are dropped. Mm. And so, you know, he proceeds to infiltrate the group. He stays with the Black Panthers after Hampton's assassination, ultimately. And then, you know, eventually reveals that he's an informant and gives an interview very famously with the documentary Eyes on the Prize in 1989.
Yeah.
And that real footage of his interview is blended into the narrative of the film. And that particularly is really, really powerful as well. And so there's a little bit of controversy because Academy Award controversy, because both Stanfield and Kaluuya are nominated for Best Supporting Actor awards, so they are in the same category, and so there was some talk of, you know, well, shouldn't one of these two men be nominated in the primary award mm-hmm. category? And so that's also interesting, and so it'll be, you know, to see if they split the vote, all right, from this film, or if Kaluuya is able to, he's favored at this point to win Best Supporting Actor, but there's some, you know, discussion that they may split the vote, and then another actor may take that category. So
All we can do is watch and wait. We're talking with Anna Thompson-Hodgick, who teaches film at UW-Whitewater. Marcy is joining us from Stevens Point. Hi, Marcy. What is your movie-going experience like?
Oh, hi. Yes, I'm an avid movie-goer. It's my preference always to see the movies in that movie show. The experience of the lights down is just one of my favorites. This year, I've gone to at least 5-6 movies, and more than once, I've been the only person in the movies. But my real issue really is it's been becoming increasingly sad for me because for various reasons, for example, streaming or political reasons, some of the movies are just movies that I will never have an opportunity to see. Whenever the Oscars, it's kind of like my Super Bowl night. But in the past couple of years, so many movies are so obscure, actually they're chosen, and the people chosen for what I perceive as primarily political reasons, that the experience, like this year, I'm going to watch the Oscars, but I'm going to see that there's movies that I've never even seen or I won't have an opportunity to see. And I'm just going to make a prediction, a lot are going to be just going to be picked for political reasons. You're going to see a lot of picked people. Black nominees are going to be selected because of what's going on in the country.
Yeah, Marcy, we're short on time. Anna, your thoughts there very quickly.
So, I mean, there's a real fear that, you know, will movie theaters rebound, in the coming years about, you know, that the streaming revolution has maybe diminished certainly the power of the theater. And, you know, notably, you have a lot of the really, you know, kind of well-known directors like, for example, Spielberg, who've kept, you know, his production of West Side Story just totally out of the field of Academy Award nominees. And he's holding out till next year to release that film, even though it's been completed for months.
And, all right, we only have a few seconds, but do you have a pick? Do you have a pick for Best Picture?
Nomadland is my pick to win. Nomadland has won all the early awards, so it's a pretty good indicator that Nomadland will win.
Well, Anna, thank you so much. You've done the best to school us. This has been fun.
Yes, it has. Thank you.
Anna Thompson-Hodgick with UW-Whitewater. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this is the Ideas Network.